This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers, rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. This episode, we're going to be talking about mental health. When we think about cancer, we often think about chemotherapy and drug treatment and keeping ourselves physically well. But cancer affects our mental health just as much as it affects our physical health, and it's absolutely vital to find ways to cope mentally. And while oncology departments are focused on getting us better physically, there is often a gap in the treatment of our mental health, which can suffer long after any physical symptoms disappear. So today we're talking to Professor Nazanin Derakhshan, or Naz, founder of the BRIC Centre, or BRIC. BRIC, which stands for Building Resilience in Breast Cancer, is an organisation that helps people who've had a breast cancer diagnosis to feel less anxious and improve their quality of life. It's run entirely by women who have had a primary or secondary breast cancer diagnosis, including Naz herself. Naz is a professor of experimental psychopathology who specialises in cognitive neuroscience of anxiety and depression at the University of Reading. And if you have no idea what that means, do not worry, because I don't either, but I will be sure to ask her. Naz was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2013 when she was in her 30s. When she finished treatment, she became aware that there was a real lack of psychological support available, particularly at that critical time after active treatment ends. She set up the BRIC Centre to apply her research into anxiety and depression to find ways to help others using neuroscientific measures. Naz, thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really nice to meet with you. Thank you.
You were diagnosed with breast cancer in 2013, about 6 months after me, actually, and right. At a very similar age. Could you tell us about your diagnosis?
Of course, my diagnosis came completely as a shock. I was diagnosed actually on the 2nd of January 2013, and no family history, no expectation of any sort to receive a diagnosis of breast cancer. And I remember very clearly the conditions, the room, the setting, and when I was told Well, this was prior to having MRI, actually. But the surgeon who saw me said, I'm absolutely 99% certain this is breast cancer. And I felt like I was distancing myself from Naz in order to protect her. So I remember my partner came through the door and I looked at him and I said, Naz has breast cancer. It felt like I've been lifted from my body, put on the other side of the room, and I would be the person now to look after Naz, to make sure Naz is going to be okay. And the first thing I said is, how much time? How much time do I have left? So it was a bit of a roller coaster, but when you are going through treatment, you feel like you are positively doing something with your medical team to combat the cancer. And it's, as you said earlier, when active treatment ends, you feel like you're a bit dropped. And that's when the challenges start revealing themselves and you're on your own to a large extent. Yeah.
That's so interesting how you referred to yourself in the third person, because I sort of had a similar feeling when I received my secondary diagnosis, okay. Where I felt like I was looking onto my own life, okay. In a way. Okay. But it's really interesting about distancing yourself and calling yourself Naz so that you sort of maybe distance yourself from the pain and perhaps it's a coping mechanism, I suppose.
It very much is. It's a traumatic experience. We're not really prepared for traumatic experiences. They come when we least expect them to. And it's a bit overwhelming for the brain. So the brain, is there for a reason to protect us. And the distancing, the numbing is is a natural response of the brain to cope with the trauma. At the time, it might be helpful, but longer term, distancing or avoiding from the negatively laden emotional experiences may not be very adaptive. But at the time, it's perfectly understandable and a natural response.
And just before we go into the science side of it, can you tell us how you're doing now physically in terms of your cancer treatment and recovery?
So it's been nearly 10 years since my diagnosis. And it's been a bit of a roller coaster up and down. I've had a few scares along the way. And of course, scan anxiety is a huge thing. So, you know, I've had moments of despair and moments of celebration. I've tried to keep physically fit. I've tried to work because challenging your brain is quite good for your health. Fingers crossed, I take every day at a time, and I'm hopeful that I'm okay. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'm sure anyone who is listening who has also had a diagnosis in the past and is currently well will know that feeling of celebrate the milestones, but there's always that fear as well, isn't there? And,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So can you explain to us what you do at the BRIC Centre for someone like me who doesn't know anything about neuroscience?
Okay. So by training, I've done quite a lot of work on understanding like the possible roots of vulnerability to anxiety and depression, trying to find ways to target anxiety and depression using interventions that are kind of based on neuroplasticity. So the idea that the brain is plastic and it can change for the better. Of course, the brain can change for the worse as well, but we don't want that. We want to be able to boost resilience through exercising the brain in ways that is adaptive, it's positive, it's constructive, and it's beneficial for the person. So, you know, you kind of feel a bit more empowered about what you do. Now, we know that cancer takes control away. You know, you kind of like feel a bit less in control of yourself in terms of planning, decision making, what the future may bring, etc. So after my active treatment, I felt like I was going into clinical depression and the self-diagnosis. And I realised that psychological support was not that very much available at the time. I know that now there are some more conditions in place, but not enough. I realised that a lot of women like myself were going through similar experiences. And I started looking up the literature, the breast cancer literature, to see what does the research show in terms of women's experiences, their coping strategies, how do they find their new normal, how are they facing these challenges after active treatment. And I was not entirely surprised to find that the literature was literally plagued with studies documenting the high risk for anxiety and depression in women with breast cancer diagnosis well into survivorship. Then I started looking at the brain studies that had been published on women with breast cancer diagnosis. And I discovered that the literature showed that the brain deficits as a function of treatment and diagnosis can last up to 25 years post-active treatment. So we are talking about damage to structure and function. It's not fair for us to suffer cognitive deficits and be at risk for anxiety and depression. So I actually started some research. I got some money from the Wellcome Trust. I started doing some research on how I could apply my work that I did prior to being diagnosed with breast cancer to a population in most need of it, women with breast cancer diagnosis. So BRIC is a centre for research and practice of resilience. And I decided to use the word resilience because resilience is about change. It's about adapting. It's about the art of adapting smartly to trauma. And it's a very dynamic thing. So BRIC became from the research and the aim to translate that research to empower women, to equip them with the tools they need to be able to face every day, you know, wake up every day, face the challenges, how they can cope better with, the psychological cost of breast cancer treatment and diagnosis.
So how do you actually help women or people who have had a breast cancer diagnosis? Do you meet with them personally? Do you do trainings? How does it work?
So with the research programme, we recruit women to participate in our studies. For example, one of the interventions that we have been using and we've developed and adapted works on boosting cognitive efficiency. And what that means that it exercises functions and structures of the brain that are particularly receptive to brain efficiency and like the prefrontal mechanisms of attention. Women suffer from lapses in attention and memory. They're not very confident. You know, their self-esteem takes a hit. Their workability is reduced. So we have embarked on a couple of projects to improve workability through improving cognitive function. And my previous work has shown that by improving cognitive efficiency, you actually reduce the risk for anxiety and depression. And you observe reductions in anxiety and depression across time. Why? Because the communication between the brain systems involved in cognitive efficiency and emotion experience are strengthened. So that's what the kind of the research does in, on that line. And we've published our research in top journals, peer-reviewed international journals like Psycho-Oncology. Now, the BRIC Centre has a psychoeducational support network. We are at the moment currently around just under 2,200 women with either primary or secondary diagnosis of breast cancer, any age across the UK. It's an online network and we have daily activities where we engage our members in different types of exercises. And we also have breathing exercises and mindfulness meditation exercises. These activities are supervised by myself and my admin team, without whom BRIC would not exist, do an incredible job in monitoring posts, monitoring conversations, and overseeing the running of these activities within the online support network. We do have meetups. We meet up regional meetups. We have Christmas meetups or summer meetups. And honestly, our women are amazing. They really make an effort to meet up and talk and have a day out, for example. But most of our activities are actually online. And it's a safe space. It's a safe place to vent, to ask questions, to share, to celebrate. And I've often referred to Brick as a Brick family. You know, we're quite a big family, but we're like a family. And we have various projects that we run, like the October month project we had on living hopefully. What does it mean to live hopefully? And we had quite a number of women with secondary breast cancer providing short reels and short videos of what it meant for them to live hopefully.
I'm really interested. I don't understand a lot of the science of it, yeah. And I'm sure lots of our listeners won't either. But I know one of the things we talk about in terms of treatment is chemo brain.
Yeah.
So is that something that you look into in your studies? And if so, can you like, is chemo brain a thing? What is it? Why am I so much more forgetful now than I was before my diagnosis over 10 years ago?
I can say with a lot of confidence that chemo brain is a real thing. The literature now refers to it as cancer-related cognitive impairment. Mm-hmm. But chemo brain works for us.
Yeah.
Brain fog. You feel like, you're not as fast, you're not as, you know, you can't concentrate as well as you can. A bit like me, sometimes I feel like I'm talking about something, then halfway through I've actually forgotten what I've just said, and I can see that people are probably thinking, what is she on about? And then I have to kind of try and remember what I've just said. So the chemo brain should not be dismissed, you know, chemo fog, brain fog. Mm. And it's not just specific to chemotherapy. Women who've done radiotherapy or just surgery can also experience chemo brain. Although chemotherapy-related brain fog can be more intense. Mm. If you consider the overwhelming amount of information that we deal with at the time of diagnosis, that puts a lot of pressure on the brain. With the addition of the fears, the uncertainties, the scan anxieties, all the plans we may or we may not put in place. Sometimes I feel like I've got a second PhD, you know, it's like I've got a second degree, you know, of all that stuff that you have to digest and keep on. And of course, there's Dr. Google, you know, you can't. Yeah. We are capacity limited. The brain doesn't have infinite capacity. So in itself, that amount of juggle and, you know, as a result of the trauma as well, the brain becomes less efficient as a result of that. Then it's picking yourself back up again after active treatment. Get out there in the new world. Get into your, you know, what's your new normal, all the changes we have to go through. That's also pressurizing the brain. The greater the expectation of people, you know, in terms of going and conquering the world, you know, make the most of it, you know, you've been given a second or third chance, etc. And the greater we are down there thinking, well, actually, you know what? I want to. I'm not that person. I'm tired. I'm fatigued. I'm not that person. And you long for that person, knowing that it'll probably not come back, that older person. And it's this new person, which you're not quite sure who this new person is. Again, pressure on the brain. And the greater this discrepancy, the greater the likelihood that you will fall into depression, because you would think, well, you know what? I can't meet expectations. I'm probably not that good anymore. I've changed. I can't work like I used to. And so you start doubting yourself. And this self-doubt also puts pressure on the brain, especially the functions of the brain that have helped you make decisions in the past, you know. So chemo brain is a thing. It shouldn't be dismissed. It should be taken seriously. The effects can be subtle, right? Like, you know, like lapses in everyday attention and memory, difficulty concentrating. But these have profound effects in, you know, on our daily lives. Sometimes you might think, well, get on with it, you know, try harder. We are trying harder. We're putting everything we can. And in fact, some of our work shows that women with breast cancer diagnosis, primary breast cancer diagnosis, compared with non-cancer controls, their brain activity in completing a simple task, a simple cognitive task, like that requires you to find whether some letters are congruent or incongruent.
What does that mean?
Like, for example, if I give you a string of letters, like all M.
Yeah.
So all the letters are congruent. And then at times I show you like the string of letters of M with an N that's incongruent.
Okay.
So you have to say whether the middle letter is the same as the ones flanked on the side or is different. And they're kind of flashed up on the computer screen in successive order. So many trials of that. Some are congruent, some are incongruent. When you look at brain activity, you find that women with breast cancer diagnosis are recruiting from a wider network and are trying harder to get the answer right, compared with women who don't have breast cancer or the healthy, well, I don't want to say healthy, not non-cancer controls. When you look at their responses, whether they made more errors or not, no difference.
Yeah.
No difference. So if we just look at performance, it's a bit misleading because we think, oh, well, actually, you did as well as the non-cancer control. But when we look at the brain, we see a difference. I had to try harder and recruit more resources to manage to achieve the outcome that you did with little effort.
So it's like the swan, the legs kicking underwater and you just don't see what's happening, but actually all of this stuff is going on in the background.
I love that
analogy. Working
harder.
Yeah. So next time I forget where I am mid-sentence, I can say, you know what? My brain is doing lots of really hard work right now, so give me a break.
Absolutely. Now imagine over time, if you're doing this for even simple task, is what happens to the brain? The brain, you know, kind of gets a bit tired, it gets a bit lethargic, it's putting more in compared to what it should be doing. So you might be at a risk of burnout.
Yes. One of the things you said then really made me think, because I think it's something that can feel more apparent in younger women, because I, like you, was diagnosed when I was 29.
Gosh.
And I was cured in 2013, when I finished my active treatment, which, by the way, I should explain, active treatment, we usually mean chemotherapy and radiotherapy. So you may be continuing with drug treatment.
Yeah.
So I went back to work and I was then well for nearly 10 years. And to look at me, you would have no idea that anything was different, because my hair grew back.
Of course.
I was still in my 30s. I was exercising. I was going to work every day, working full time. I was fully functional on the outside. But I would experience all of those things that you've mentioned. And I know that my brain had changed.
Mm-hmm.
But because people didn't have this expectation of me, it was like I felt like I had to sort of qualify the fact that I felt I had to work even harder than how my brain was working underneath, because I had to prove myself even more, because I was a 35-year-old woman who had overcome breast cancer But I wanted to show that I was just as capable as all my colleagues. And I was tireder and I was without a doubt burnt out at times. And yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge that, I think, because I think it can be incredibly hard for women of working age who go back to work after a breast cancer diagnosis, or like me now living with breast cancer, because your brain is working really hard. And I'm really glad that you've acknowledged that, you know, there's a scientific reason behind all that.
Absolutely. So, it's real. It's legitimate, you know, and it's it has profound impact. And being a younger woman is a risk factor for greater anxiety and depression. The literature shows this. There was a meta-analysis that came out in 2020. It's published in the journal Molecular Psychiatry. And the meta-analysis is a study where you kind of gather lots and lots of findings from lots of studies together and see whether, like, the overall finding is a reliable one or not. They find that being younger, greater risk of anxiety and depression. So this is an important issue. And getting a breast cancer diagnosis at any age is not a good thing. So we're not comparing older versus younger women. But when we look at the data, we see that they are more affected physiologically, cognitively, neurologically, and performance-wise.
And if I've understood correctly from what you've explained previously, all of that pressure on my brain is, you know, weighing on me every single day. What if I die? What if I lose my job? What if I can't work? What if I've got no money? What is going to happen to my family?
Yeah.
All of that is building, making the brain work harder. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The brain work harder, but also... the brain systems that are involved in emotions, emotion experiences, they go a bit on an overdrive. So they're firing more than they should be because of the worries, because of the concerns, because of, you know, the profound effect of loss on your family, on your children, on your status, etc. They weigh heavy on the brain, and those emotional systems, when they go on overdrive, because we are evolutionary kind of primed to survive, you know, the parts of the brain, the functions that's supposed to regulate them and say, well, you know what, it's going to be okay, you've got this, they actually stop doing that and say, they take a backseat and they say, well, actually, you know what, your concerns are pretty real. And so they take a back seat, and then you get this constant overdrive of these emotional systems, and they weigh you down.
This is so fascinating, because I'm one of those patients who, when I see my oncologist or the nurses at the hospital, I'm the person asking, but why, okay, about all the physical stuff. So, you know, what does this drug do? How is this drug gonna block my estrogen, and how is that going to make the cancer not come back, etc. Yeah. But I've never had the opportunity to sit down and talk to someone about what is going on in my brain, which actually has been, it's a 50-50 really, you know, it's probably more important than the physical stuff, actually.
Absolutely. And hormones also play a role when we talk about endocrine therapy and tamoxifen, and, you know, they're kind of like chipping away at the brain, you know, slowly. Tamoxifen is a neurotoxic drug. It is a neurotoxic.
What does neurotoxic mean? That it damages the brain?
Yes. It has, you know, it kind of, through its effect on estrogen, ripping your, you know, estrogen is a very important hormone for the brain, you know, for vitality, cognitive vitality, you know. And it has a very good prognosis for preventing recurrence and metastases, but there is evidence that it does have these side effects.
When we talk about these drugs that block estrogen, which in some people's cancer, estrogen is the thing that feeds their cancer. And of course, these drugs create menopausal effects. And when we talk about menopause, we talk about this loss of cognitive function as well. So it's all links in, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely. When we go through treatment and we experience menopausal symptoms, they're more radical than the naturally occurring menopausal symptoms. Right. So, especially for younger women. When you are chemically induced menopausal status, you have a bigger impact of that on your brain. So imagine like a sharp, you know, hit to the brain. That's a shock in itself for the brain. And we are prescribed tamoxifen or in different types of endocrine therapy for many years post. You know, I've just finished mine now. Tamoxifen, 10 years, I've finished. And I have a review due with my oncology team to see where we go from here. And I'm concerned as well that what am I going to be put on? Do I continue with tamoxifen? Do I stop tamoxifen? Am I going to be put on something else? How are those side effects going to emerge? Mm. So it's a bit of an uncertainty for me, and I'm a little bit anxious about it.
One of the things you've talked about is that you felt this sudden change in your mental health. You felt a C, I suppose, when you finished your active treatment. So when you finished your radiotherapy, chemotherapy. I, in early 2013, finished my radiotherapy, and that was when the real mental health impact came for me. So that was when I found myself depressed for the first time in my life at 30. And everyone I've met over the years has been the same. You know, so many people say that when they are no longer going to hospital every day or every month, or they're under the care of that oncology team, they feel depressed, or they feel anxious. Yeah. Why is that?
It's a profound question, one that is felt by lots of us. You feel like your blanket's kind of ripped off you. You know, you feel alone, a drop in an ocean, trying to swim, find your way to the shore, I say, on your own. You've previously had people helping you swim, but now you're on your own, and you've gone through a lot, and you are you have to face this unknown person who is changing over time. You know, the new normal, I have a bit of an issue with the terminology, because I believe we are changing all the time. The symptoms, you know, the diversity of symptoms that we experience. You're on your own, you're alone, and you have to cope. And you think, well, you know, actually, I don't have the resources to cope, but I should have the resources to cope. And that's when you feel depressed. It was after my chemotherapy, then radiotherapy, I felt I was so looking forward to that last session of radiotherapy. The next day, I woke up, and I think I literally cried the whole day. Where am I? What am I doing? What's happening? Should I go back to work today? I was confused. You are out of that support zone. You know, we're all vulnerable, but some of us are more vulnerable than others. And I think that women need education and continued support. That's why there are centres like BRIC to provide that for women. I know it's not possible on the NHS because of funding, etc. But it needs to be recognised that, you know, many of us contribute to society. We need to get back out there. We need to work. We need to raise children. We need to be partners. We need to do this, you know, and we need to be well enough to do this. So we can cost the society, you know, economically, if financially, if you just think about that angle, if we're not well enough to go out there. And then we have all these kind of scares. Oh, is it back? The migraine, the pain, So consulting our medical teams, you know, all this patient, you know, I have heard many times complaints about, oh, you know, this patient, we know her, we know him, they're always back here scared of, you know, signs and symptoms, etc. So if we are if we have that support, if we have that psychoeducation, and there's nothing wrong, we're not weak, everyone needs that, you know, we all need good level of support so that then we can independently get out there and do what we can do to our best of ability.
I think a huge part of it, when you, at that point where you finish the treatment and you feel lost at sea, it's also about other people's expectations, because when you finish cancer treatment and you are effectively cured, people think therefore that you must be fine. So it's also, I think, about educating the people around us, including our employers, which is something that we're talking about separately on this podcast, about what we need, and that our brains aren't okay, that we're gonna we're going through grief, we're going through depression, we're going through anxiety, we've had a loss, we've got so much going on in our brains. So what would you say to someone who is perhaps at that period now, they're finishing their active treatment, they're about to maybe go back to work, or maybe they're not going back to work, but they're at that really down point where they're scared?
To embrace the fears. This is the time we need to embrace the fears, embrace the grief, the loss. It is a loss. We have lost a big chunk of ourselves psychologically and womanhood, physically, etc. And we, you know, it's interesting because immediately after active treatment, you kind of like feel this downward spiral of depression hitting. And then as time goes by, that lifts and you become more anxious. So anxiety and the fear of recurrence, metastasis, then starts going up when you kind of feel like the depression is lifting. But then you can move between the two, because depression and anxiety are highly comorbid.
What does comorbid mean?
So they're very linked.
Okay.
So if you have anxiety, you are very likely to go through periods of depression. So they can co-occur. The idea is that don't demand too much of yourself at that particular time. People will say things that will make you expect to be over the moon and 200% energy going out there and doing the marathons, mentally or physically. But meeting others' expectations is not your job right now. It's about nourishing yourself mentally, psychologically, loving yourself, embracing the fears, embracing the grief, and going slowly. You will go faster, but you'll know when.
I think also, just to add to that, that social media is amazing. If you've had breast cancer and you are on, say, Instagram, it can be a brilliant community, it can be a brilliant support, but it could also add pressure because of comparison, because you just mentioned running marathons. You know, if you're in a down day, you know, I am on an absolute roller coaster and I go through massive ups and massive downs. And if on one of my massive down days, I go on Instagram and I see a fellow secondary breast cancer patient, for example, doing a TED talk or doing a running a marathon or whatever, that could easily have a worsening effect on me. So what about our relationship with social media, and how can we, like, should we avoid social media when we're at our most depressed?
I don't want to say avoid, because then you kind of feel a bit self-depreciative. I wasn't able to digest that, or, you know, people think I'm jealous, or I'm not good enough, or, you know, acceptance here is the big thing. And acceptance is hard because brain-wise, at that time, we are quite fragile. We don't want to accept the downs. I mean, it was very hard for me to accept the down. I remember when I went back to work, and I wanted to work very quickly after my active treatment, the worry about making a fool of myself in the lecture theatre made me even forget more things. Yeah. And I remember lecturing and I couldn't hear my voice. And I wanted to be like this award-winning lecturer who's gone back and has managed to, you know, be on top of, but I wasn't. And I know at some points I was very forgetful, perhaps. My students were amazing. They never said anything to that effect to me. But it's a real thing. Go slow when you have to. It doesn't mean it's always going to be like that. I think that's the thing. When we are on a high and we do have the passion and energy to fulfill expectations, we think it's going to be like that all the time. And when we're in a low, we also feel, oh, we can't stand it. It's going to be like that. This is me. That's it. I'm toast. I'm no use. No, we change all the time. And that's the beauty of being a human being, is to embrace the change, even if it is being in a slump, you know. People say, oh, well, it's the thought, it's not you. But sometimes you think, well, actually, it is me. I've been at home all day watching back-to-back episodes of The Good Wife, like I used to do, you know. And I've just finished it, actually. I might go back and watch it again. But I know that I can't beat myself up about it. Even I know I shouldn't be doing this. Be nice to yourself. If you have a broken leg and you're discharged from hospital, what is your expectation of your leg? To run? To walk fast? To be... No. Do you demand it to get better really quickly and, you know, kind of be, why am I not getting quickly? Well, in that case, you don't have expectations of others because people can see that you are physically injured.
Yeah.
People can't see we are psychologically injured. And that's when the expectation rises. But you're nice to your leg. You make sure it's seen to and it's bandaged. You don't battle with it and say, why aren't you getting better? You're nice and you know with TLC, it's probably going to heal faster. It's exactly the same with your brain. If your brain's fried, down in the dumps, be nice to it.
I've often thought, actually, over the years of having cancer, that when you say you've got cancer, people immediately go, oh, wow, that's the big one. And they immediately get it. But if you are depressed or have other mental health issues, people don't treat that with the same level of understanding, kindness, acceptance. And if you have cancer and depression, you know, you have the double whammy. It's just something that people don't understand or treat. And, you know, we're changing in the ways we talk about these things, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
In the same way as you can say cancer and everyone's like, okay, totally understand, you know.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, you know, we go back to the beginning of our conversation when you looked at yourself and you said to your partner, Naz has cancer, whether there's an acknowledgement thing. So you talked about acceptance, but I'm wondering about acknowledgement in the sense of me saying, Laura, you are comparing yourself to that person. Laura, you are being unfair to yourself. Also, I beat myself up when I'm not working enough or I'm not being productive enough, whereas actually I've just had a massive operation. I don't feel like working. I don't feel capable. My brain doesn't feel capable, even if my body does. And so it's like acknowledging those things as well in order to accept them, I think.
Absolutely. Acknowledging them. And by acknowledging them, they won't be as threatening. I think, you know, the literature shows that avoidance of trauma, of psychological pain, is the biggest predictor of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So avoidance is actually a long-term maladaptive coping strategy. But facing, confronting, acknowledging requires that cognitive efficiency we need, which we have lost. Embracing is difficult. It's difficult to sit with the pain or to sit with, you know, I haven't had a productive day, especially when we are competitive and we don't want to kind of be, known otherwise. But sometimes acknowledging a source of fear, acknowledging, loss, depression, etc., that is actually quite healthy. And that lessens the catastrophizing nature of it for us. When we say cancer and people go, oh wow, you know, it's a massive thing, it's very much seen as a physical disease, so you've got like a tumor somewhere, but cancer is a very much a psychological thing as well. The mind, brain, and the body speak to each other. You can't separate the two. So there's so much we don't know about cancer. So the psychological cost of cancer is harder to deal with than the physical cost, I believe.
So you conduct trainings and meetups to help women affected by breast cancer to deal with difficult thoughts and anxiety. So I wanted to ask you about three different areas that I know affect a lot of people in the cancer community, including me. So the first one is scanxiety or scan anxiety, which is spiraling thoughts before a scan. So are there some tools that you could give to people to cope with that?
One-off tools are attractive. Say, oh, do this and it's going to go away. What I would suggest is to take more of a prolonged approach in kind of beefing up your confidence, your self-esteem, your like brain health. Therapy takes time. You know, when you want to change something, it needs to take time, slowly, one step at a time. So if we engage in activities, daily activities, that challenge our brain in exciting ways, in pushing the boundary, you will feel more empowered to cope with that anxiety. One thing I'd say quite bluntly is that if you think about using something to eradicate a fear, it's not going to work. Thinking, okay, well, I'm going to get rid of my scan anxiety. It's not. Why? Because the scan anxiety, first of all, it's highly uncertain outcome. Mm-hmm. The anxiety is evolutionary there, the fear. So trying to kind of suppress that fear goes counter to how we are made evolutionary. So managing that anxiety is the way forward. Managing it, acknowledging it's there, the outcome, I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm going to be prepared mentally, and there will be a plan. We will be able to cope the best that we can. And worrying is natural in this sense, but worrying about an outcome that I have very little control over, perhaps not so much. We need to balance it and acknowledge the fear. It's going to be pretty tough, absolutely. I've had those scan anxieties before, and honestly, sometimes I have felt I'm not coping properly. I'm looking at the person's face to see whether I can read something from it prior to them giving me the answer. It's normal. It's your life. the impact on your life. So of course your anxiety is going to go through the roof.
Yeah. My next one is thoughts of death and fear of dying. Now, I know that your response might be similar because, as you said, it's a long process and there's acceptance and so much more to it. But let's say, for example, you are a secondary breast cancer patient like me, and you know that death is more likely or perhaps to come sooner. So are there any things that you can do or say to help someone who is just having those constant anxious spiraling thoughts of death?
This is a very pertinent question, very real, and it's not irrational to have those thoughts. It's very rational to have those thoughts. What I would suggest, and this may feel like a bit of a cliche, but taking it, like they say, one day at a time, 1 minute at a time, being in the moment and all. I mean, being in the moment is great, but if the moment is full of death thoughts, it's probably not that great, you know. So it's about, again, with the acceptance, but also think big. Think big. Because what is happening there is that you're living in that head of yours, you know, the thoughts of, even when death isn't imminent, it is in your head. So I would bypass that and think big. What's your next plan? What's the next big thing you want to do? Think big within the constraints that you have.
Can I challenge that by saying, I think that at a certain stage in a secondary breast cancer experience, you're going to find it very hard to think big.
Yeah.
So would it be better in some cases to think small and to think, tonight I'm going to watch a TV program and I'm going to really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Or today I'm going to try and make it to the kitchen to make a cup of tea for myself rather than asking someone else to do it. And maybe think small, or is that not what
that,
you're saying?
That is the think big in my head, not the think big that I'm going to go do world travel.
Yeah.
No, things that you think, well, actually, this is too difficult for me to do. Imagine if you're feeling depressed. You're not particularly excited about that show, or you're not particularly excited. What's the point in making a cup of tea? What's the point? If thinking big is to kind of move out of that and make the making a cup of tea big for yourself.
Right.
It's not. It's a small thing, in effect, like I'm making a cup of tea and enjoying it on the sofa while I watch another episode of The Good Wife. But it's a big, make it a big thing for yourself.
Right.
That you have managed to do this, and you know what? It's pretty damn good.
So it's sort of about making bigger things in a smaller, in a shrunken world, if that's the right way to say it.
Yeah.
So it's like your world has got much, much smaller, but think of things, that moments you can have and things you can do that maybe you don't feel like doing.
Exactly.
But maybe it's just about, I'm going to get dressed today, or I'm going to have a shower.
That's going to be amazing.
You never want that shower, but when you have it, it can make you feel so much better. So.
And make that a big achievement for yourself. Mm. Feel proud of it. It might seem little to someone else, but it's a big in your head. It's a big achievement. And by doing that in successive order, what you will feel is that actually you may, you know, not be able to go out, but you may be able to write about it and do the next big thing. How can I make this work for me? I don't have all the luxuries that other people have, but I can make what I've got within me so big that it can be very impactful.
I know that I can relate that to my own experience in that I had a big major operation in January 2023. I had my sternum bone removed. And that first day in the high dependency unit, my big thing was making it to the door of the room, a tiny little room. Yes. That was such a big thing for me. It was just taking those three steps.
Yes.
And it was a huge achievement. It was like being a baby who'd just taken its first step. It was,
That's what I mean. Think big within what you've...
Your parameters.
When I was doing chemotherapy, I got sepsis three times.
Oh, wow.
And for me, but because I had to be separated because of the neutrophils, etc. For me also, the fact that I could actually walk around the room. And at some point when I felt better, I remember going to the roof. There was a kind of a rooftop landing in the hospital. And I remember sitting up there and thinking, I've conquered it.
Yeah.
I'm alive. And I'm up here. This is the best moment of my life.
Mm.
And when I look back, I'm getting a bit goosebumpy here. I feel like, it probably was.
When your life becomes smaller and more limited, making a cup of tea or stepping outside your front door is as big as climbing a mountain.
I totally agree. And realising that, being aware of it and embracing it and feeling good about it, I think it has the same physiological reaction as getting to the top of Mount Everest. I mean, all these years after, just kind of, I remember going on that landing and I get goosebumps just speaking of it. So it means the memory of that time is still very much alive in me.
Mm.
And it's still having a profound effect on me.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily getting rid of the negative, getting rid of those dying thoughts. No, they're there. They're real. But that's not the only thing there. We can have these other celebrating things we're doing also there. And in order to keep the balance, you need both ends.
So my third one is just empty thoughts and generally feeling depressed and helpless or hopeless.
What my suggestion would be. I'm going to suggest something that kind of has worked for me. And I think that the literature, the research also backs this up. So... I'm going to bring in you an example. If you say to someone who, someone says, I have empty thoughts, I'm very low, depressed, nothingness. So depression is quite usually associated with nothingness. There's no point, hopeless, helpless. If you try and encourage them to think positive thoughts, it's exactly like saying to someone who has Alzheimer's disease to try harder to remember.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. The literature shows that individuals with high levels of depression have blunted neurological responses to positive stimuli.
Right.
So it's not their fault. They just cannot process positive stimuli like other people who are not depressed do. And if you speak with someone who actually says that they have empty thoughts, you will realise they actually have quite a lot of thoughts that they can bring to conscious awareness when you give them the time and space to talk. At times, when we hear about empty thoughts, emptiness, it's a way of saying, I don't really have anything to say you want to hear.
Yeah.
Another... this goes back to some of the research findings that I'm going to touch on. When you have empty thoughts, it actually can be a coping mechanism because of all the painful thoughts that are too much. But you're not with empty thoughts. You have lots of thoughts. It's just you can't access them or they're too painful to be processed. And that's okay. Sit with it.
Everything you've just said completely resonates with me. For example, when I'm feeling depressed, if my husband says something to make me laugh, it would normally make me laugh because he's very funny. He'll love that I said that. But on those days, it won't make me laugh. I'll just be, stony-faced, sort of it would make me cry actually sometimes because I think, why aren't I, why am I not laughing like I normally do? Why am I not me? And I find myself apologizing and saying, I'm really sorry that I'm like this because I'm not myself at the moment. And it's that feeling of not being yourself.
Yeah.
You know, your brain is not working at that point. And for me, I get better and I've got highs and lows.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's you've really explained, thank you,
no worries.
You know, why the positive thoughts don't work on top of that. What is the most effective tool you'd recommend people with breast cancer to use to improve their mental health and quality of life after cancer or with cancer?
Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. The bads and the goods. Believe in yourself. Self-doubt, self-depreciation, you know, as a result of what's happened to you can take its toll. Don't shy away, don't run away from the hard stuff. Be there, get help, seek support, but believe in yourself. I think one of the biggest things we're confronted psychologically is that we lose faith in ourselves. We think, well, you know, our body's gone rogue, our minds have gone rogue, we can't cope. And slowly we tend to self-depreciate, apologize, and you know, think, well, maybe there is no hope, maybe no, in the worst times there is hope, and it comes from us, not from an external. So love yourself, love those injuries, your psychological injuries, just as you heal your physical injuries. Love yourself, don't hate yourself. I remember for a long time after my surgeries, I had double mastectomy, I couldn't look in the mirror and identify with them. I couldn't touch my rogue boob, you know. Why did I feel disgusted with myself? Why did I not like... No, that's part of me. Just like that, your anxieties, your fears, your grieving, you feel guilty, you know, it's all there. You know, our emotions are adaptive. They're there for good reason. And embrace the bad, celebrate the good. And self-love is very important, but believing in yourself that you can. You know, some people say, oh, it's false. You know, what do they say? Blind optimism. It's not blind optimism. Believe in yourself.
Yeah. Naz, this has been absolutely fascinating and illuminating, and I've learned so much. So thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honour and pleasure. Thank you so much.
You. If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.